This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
One of the buzzwords of the current political dialogue on medical care is how to measure what are the metrics of quality care. And we all seen politicians and regulators pontificating in front of TV about quality care and so on. And clearly, this is not a subject that lends itself to either simplicity or sound bites. And I'm sure Dr. Hiroshi, our next speaker, is going to give us a much more rational explanation of how to measure quality care and outcomes in transplantation.
Thanks, Flavio.
Good afternoon. Thanks, Flavio. One of my younger nephrology colleagues said I should just get up here and say UCSF has outstanding quality and then just sit down. But I'm going to try to dig a little bit deeper in the woods and talk about how one actually measures quality at transplant centers. And this will spill over in how one measures quality in healthcare delivery in general. And we can learn from other industries as to how quality is measured in other areas, because more and more, as Dr. Vincenti refers to, we're going to be all held, not just transplant centers, but all physicians are being held to delivering quality care. There's going to be metrics developed and maybe developed by us as opposed to regulators. And it's going to really affect reimbursement as well as having national benchmarks of how you do as a team, how we do as a team, and also as individual providers. So I think it's very important for us to all think about the metrics that we use to measure the quality at a particular transplant center, at a particular hospital, but also as individual practitioners, as you know, one surgeon versus another, one nephrologist versus another. How do you actually think about doing that? And it takes a lot of smart people to really think about how one measures and how one appropriately measures these things. Because external regulators, coders, all these things, they're publishing these things publicly with or without our consent. So unless we get involved in the grassroots level of how one actually measures this sort of quality, it's going to affect us in a big way, in many ways. So this is why I think it's relevant and important to all of us in the room. So in terms of sports, you know, the NBA playoffs are just starting. So in terms of metrics that we use to look at individual quality versus a team metric, you can look at this guy in the picture, and we know that he represents excellence and quality. Now, some of these things that he accomplished, certainly he has six rings, one for each finger on one hand and another. He's won the MVP award five times. He was 10 times an all-NBA first-team starter and 14-time All-Star. In terms of individual metrics, his field goal percentage in basketball was nearly 50% with nearly one-third of his three-point field goals going in. And points per game, he scored 30 points per game. Unbelievable individual metrics. Now, what about team metrics? Arguably, the 1995-1996 Chicago Bulls was one of the best teams in all of NBA history. Now, how do you measure that? Well, 72-10, unbelievable regular season record, 72 wins. No one actually has come up with even more than 70 wins either before or since. There are individual achievements, and you have to have individual outstanding team members to get a team metric. And Jordan not only won his eighth scoring title during the season, but Rodman won his fifth rebounding title, and Steve Kerr was the second in the league in three-point percentage. So you had three individual members of this team that were almost the best in their little area. And obviously, this team went on to win three championships in a row. So this was their first of second, two repeats, three-peats. And in the playoffs, they had an unbelievable 15-3 winning record, winning the NBA championship 4-2 over Seattle. In terms of metrics, you know, some sports folks have really focused on the wrong thing. If you look at team results, you can look at win losses. The Boston Red Sox actually were World Series champs last year. They went to worst to first. In 2012, their season was 69-93. They actually went to 97 at 65 the very next year. What did they do to improve their performance? Well, they did a lot. First of all, there was a huge change in leadership, which actually went to a change in culture. Bobby Valentine is a very different manager than Farrell, and there was much more team chemistry in that World Series winning Red Sox team. Like I said, if you look at individual metrics, you know, people talk about 20-game winners and those sort of things. That actually is a very poor metric for pitchers, if you think about it. Because the number of wins and losses that a pitcher has is dependent on your team. It's dependent on how many runs, run support that you get. So if you lose 10 games or 15 games or 20, and many of those become are coming as a result of your team not scoring any runs, you can't actually win any games. So there are much better individual metrics that we can think about for a pitcher, such as earned run average, WHIP, which is walks and hits per inning. And if you look at Koji Uehara last year, he had pretty much the best performance of any pitcher in history since the All-Star break. He had an ERA of 0.28, and his batting average against was 0. I'm sorry, he had 41 strikeouts and versus one walk, an unbelievable strikeout to base to walks ratio. David Ortiz was an unbelievably clutch hitter. He was he batted an average of .688 with an on-base percentage of .76, OPS of 1.9. So in terms of measuring quality, baseball has really come a long way in terms of figuring out who to draft. And if you ever read the book Moneyball by Michael Lewis, he came up with not looking at just simply batting average, but on-base percentage as a individual metric that was more important in terms of scoring runs. Now, the other thing we're going to be held to is not just having a high-quality team, because if you spend enough, like the New York Yankees, you can buy the best players. But the Oakland A's doesn't have that catchment. They don't have the unlimited budget. And they have one of the lowest payrolls in the major league. So they are interested in value, which is quality over cost. And this is the equation that we're going to have to deal with, not just increasing quality, but decreasing cost at the same time. All right, so let's go on to medicine and see how we can apply some of these concepts. In terms of the whole issue of performance improvement, really things took a big sea change when To Err is Human by the Institute of Medicine was released in 2000, and they focused our attention on medical errors and preventable deaths. There was a huge increase in the knowledge of what actually caused some of the preventable death, and it was really profoundly a wake-up call for all of us in terms of how many preventable deaths were actually happening in our hospitals. It focused on a systems approach to patient safety and in improving processes and not necessarily blaming individuals. Now, there's no doubt that individuals still must be held accountable and held responsible, but it appears that many patient safety issues are systems-based, and therefore systems fixes are what's going to change patient safety. Their follow-up to Crossing the Quality Chasm, to me, was a little bit disappointing in that it went into the weeds of how one does this, but To Err is Human is really quite an important read for all of us. In terms of what are the effects of the environment on quality, in terms of the domain of quality, there's patient safety and safe care. And then there's also appropriateness of care as well, that the practices that we have are consistent with current medical knowledge and evidence-based. And then, of course, there's customization for the individual patient and our ability to meet customer-specific values. There are multiple external forces, as Flavio mentioned, to drive quality right now. There's the regulatory and legislative pressures that we're all up against. And I'll outline what some of the regulatory environments are that govern transplant programs. Actually, transplant, I would argue, is one of the most highly regulated and highly observed and monitored areas in all of medicine. And, of course, now there will be further economic and other incentives to not only measure quality but show that we are giving quality care. Much of the CMS value-based purchasing will be based on quality metrics. There's a role for professional societies as well to help set the norms and the standard of practice and the expectation that the delivery of safe, high-quality care becomes standard and also continuing to promote the culture of safety and improvement. So what are the classic lapses in quality? Well, there's misuse, overuse, and underuse. There's avoidable complications. Overuse, that is, giving services that aren't necessarily either indicated or necessary. You know, we have two different kinds of sort of perverse incentive systems, one in which the more you do, the more you get. And then if you get just a flat fee for everything, then the less you do. Or if you don't get any more for doing more, then you might under service. Neither incentive model actually works particularly well for patients. So we all have to think about what would promote appropriate care and not overuse or underuse. Now, the first misuse or avoidable complications may be addressed by patient safety initiatives, but the second and third pieces of what, when someone needs a transplant or when someone should get a transplant, when someone shouldn't get a transplant, have to be addressed by evidence-based practice. And unfortunately, there's sometimes very limited data to drive us into what should be or shouldn't be done for a particular patient. So again, what the question, original question that that everyone in this room should be able to answer at the end of this talk is, how is quality currently measured at transplant centers? Well, there are multiple regulatory agencies involved that are trying to look at this. The most important to transplant centers right now is CMS. CMS has conditions of participation not only for all hospitals, but for all transplant centers. So they have very specific conditions of participation. And one of the most important conditions of participation, which CMS audits have been focusing on as of late, is their QAPI process, or their Quality Assurance and Performance Improvement Program. This is what the focused efforts of CMS has been on transplant centers over the last year. In addition, UNOS, which is the United Network for Organ Sharing, holds the Organ Procurement Transplant Network contract right now, and they have policies and procedures as well as regulations and other criteria to stay and become, or become and stay, a member in good standing, which allows you to participate in organ transplantation. And they have a particular subcommittee, the Membership Professionalism Committee, that reviews centers if they don't fall within certain guidelines. Okay, so what are the QA programs that are mandated by CMS? Well, they're based on other industry models, and whatever model one picks for their QAPI program, whether it's as simple as a PDSA, the Plan, Do, Study, Act sort of circle that everyone has seen, or Six Sigma, or some of the lean projects that have been touted by the Toyota company and others to really be involved in healthcare systems and to preserve value with less inefficiency to reduce waste. The QAPI program must have an outline and structure that helps actually improve in terms of both reducing costs and increasing efficiency, improving workflows. So all transplant programs, by definition, under the conditions of participations, are mandated by CMS to have a QAPI program, and they must look at both process and outcome measures for the three phases of care that we have in transplant patients. And those three phases are defined by CMS as the pre-transplant phase, the sort of peri-transplant phase, and the post-transplant phase. So we, as well as every other transplant center in the country, have to have a QA program that looks at all three phases and both process and outcome measures. Oops. Sorry. Now, we are mandated, we meaning all transplant centers, are mandated to collect and submit data to UNOS regarding every single transplant candidate that we list, as well as every transplant recipient that gets transplanted, and also post-transplant. So there's a huge amount of data collection and submission that is mandated by UNOS via their contract with the U.S. government. And so that is a huge amount of data that's being submitted. From that data are calculated often our expected numbers of patients that are dying, that are getting transplanted, that we're transplanting, what their outcomes should be. And that is the basis for which the organization called SRTR comes out with those numbers that John Roberts showed at the very beginning. Organ procurement agencies or organizations such as California Transplant Donor Network, which is where we are, also has to provide deceased donor data and performance data as well in terms of conversions, consent rates, et cetera, for very eligible deaths. And so those are all submitted through UNOS, and CMS examines all of these. That data is then looked at and analyzed by what's called the SRTR. The SRTR is a Scientific Registry of Transplant Recipients, and they give out very regular program-specific reports. Again, Dr. Roberts presented some of our SRTR, the latest SRTR data that we have. But the three most important things that they publish in terms of transplant centers is their waitlist mortality, really a metric of pre-transplant care, and as far as I'm concerned, more a measurement of how you guys are doing as opposed to us. Because in terms of what the waitlist mortality is, how good you're taking care of those waitlists of patients obviously affects waitlist mortality. Transplant rates is another metric that we are measured up against, but that unfortunately is much more dependent upon supply and demand. By supply, I mean eligible deaths, eligible donor deaths, versus not just acceptance practices by the transplant surgeons and nephrologists and candidate listings, but also conversion rates, in other words, how good an OPO is good, how good they are at getting consent from their deceased patient's loved ones. And finally, one-year patient and graft survival, 1 and 3 year patient graft survival, is a post-transplant outcome that is published and really looked at in terms of the observed versus expected rate of graft loss and patient loss. And those are all published. And if you fall outside the expected range, if you're below your expected performance, that's a flag for both UNOS as well as CMS to come visit you and potentially even have a withdrawal of CMS payments. So these SRTR program-specific reports are used both by UNOS to flag programs and used by CMS. And these are all available to the general public through the SRTR website. So what are the center-specific results look like? Well, these, again, to go back to my original nomenclature, these are all team metrics. And by that, I mean these sort of results, such as one-year and three-year patient and graft survival, is an integrated signal. It really measures a lot of stuff. It measures how good we are at selecting our candidates. And how is that clutch of patients determined? Well, it's determined first by who's referred to us, by the nephrologists, by our selection committee made up of both transplant surgeons, transplant nephrologists, as well as social workers and nurses. The surgeon themselves, when they get an offer, whether to accept that donor offer or not to for that particular recipient. And then the donors themselves. What's a donor like? What are the demographics? How old is that donor? Donor management done by OPOs. That actually has been shown to affect outcome as well. So donor selection in terms of general, in general and for a specific recipient will affect one-year patient and graft survival. Their interactions, the matching, the level of HLA matching, or the lack of antibody responses for a particular donor, the size mismatch between a donor and recipient. And then there's things that are under the surgeon's control, such as, you know, how well did I do? Did I cause a lot of bleeding? Did I technically perform the operation okay? Or even if I technically performed it well, how well did the anesthesiologist keep the blood pressure during the case? And then post-op management, our infectious disease colleagues, our nephrologists, our intensivists, all these people contribute to one-year patient and graft survival. So this metric of one-year patient and graft survival, it doesn't make sense to, for example, have surgeon-specific or provider-specific reports that drill down on one-year and three-year graft survival because it's an integrated signal. So it's a poor individual metric. I'd say it's a good team metric in terms of how good one particular center is, but we shouldn't really look at specific center-specific results and say, oh, we should just provide this data according to provider, according to Dr. Vincenti who evaluated, or according to me who actually did the case. I think that these would be very poor individual metrics. So is there a huge variation in outcomes from center to center? And the answer is yes. There is a fairly decent amount of variation in outcome. And UNOS and MPSC look at this especially and feed that data onto CMS. And national coverage decisions are made. And flagging by CMS is really set on criteria in terms of how many reporting periods that are worse than expected. And if you're, the difference between the number of observed events, such as death, is so much more than you're expected. In other words, if there's more than absolute three, if your O to E ratio is more than 1.5, that is, you have 50% more observed deaths than you're expected. And that p-value happens to be less than 0.05, that's, you know, 95% sure that it's not just by chance, this can result in a review or what's called a possible SIA. And I'll go into it. This is a slide from CMS. These are things that steps happen before a transplant center is terminated from Medicare. If you're terminated from Medicare, Medicare will not pay for a transplant at your center, and that's a huge deal. But to get there, you have to have gone through several hoops, that your numbers of deaths or graft failures exceeds 150% of risk-adjusted expected number, and I'll go into what is actually involved in the risk adjustment, that your observed minus expected failure exceeds three, that you have at least three more deaths or graft failures than you, and that is in there for smaller programs. The one-sided p-value is less than 0.05, that is statistically significant. And then the centers can actually submit mitigating factors that are outside the center control that may have effects on these. So in terms of outcome, most of the outcomes result in, if they're being flagged for these reasons, a program will enter what's called an SIA, or System Improvement Agreement, where they submit to CMS what their improvement plan is, and to show that actually they have effects on this. Now, the problem with that is that there's a delay built in as to what you actually do for improvement and what you may actually see in terms of 1 year and 3 year patient and graft survival. And unfortunately, you usually have only 12 to 24 months to show that you've made a turnaround. But in any event, most of the SIAs are successfully done and successfully come out of SIAs to come back to being CMS certified. There are very few programs that have been terminated for Medicare. Now, if you have an O-to-E ratio that's high, higher than 100% but less than 150, a center can enter a voluntary QI program to make sure that you're actually getting better. And I'll show you how a program might detect that before you enter the statistically significant changes in patient and graft survival. If you have an O-to-E greater than 150% and you don't have adequate action, again, the worst-case scenario is that you can get terminated from Medicare. So again, these center-specific results are the basis on which CMS flags programs. We all do play a team sport, and these are integrated signals. So waitlist mortality, referral patterns affect that, selection criteria, waitlist management, who we delist, that all affects waitlist mortality. Also, accurate documentation of comorbidities, because waitlist mortality is basically compared to the expected. I talked about the SRTR. It's currently held by Minneapolis right now. And I'll skip over these slides and talk about what the SRTR provides. Again, they give us risk stratified results. They also now give what's called the QSUM result, and I'll get into that a little later about what a QSUM chart is. It's actually a real-time analysis to trend events over time, and that signals potentially concerning event rates before you reach significance. And it's a way that industries have used to look at quality control to make sure that you don't have significant events accumulating over time in a more than expected fashion. Okay, so let's look at what our recent UCSF SRTR data looks like. Again, Dr. Roberts went over some of this. These are the total waiting list populations and how many are active, how many we add every year, and how many transplants we've done in these two reporting periods, the two reporting periods being FY 11 to 12 and FY 12 to 13. These are the numbers of transplants that we did, and that's relatively stable. What are the demographics of the transplant recipients compared to the nation? You can see the ethnicity, quite a bit skewed in terms of larger numbers of Hispanics that we transplanted, and certainly a hugely larger number of Asian Americans that we transplanted at UCSF under the center column versus the entire United States. The age demographics, we transplant 46% of the patients that are aged 50 to 64 years of age, and about 20% of our patients are aged 65 and up. That's comparable to the national average in terms of demographics of who we are transplanting. So how is the risk model done for waitlist mortality? Well, it's actually not that many variables that are go into calculating the expected waitlist mortality. They include age, blood type, the diagnosis that led to renal failure, the gender, the race, and the time from listing. So if you look at observed to expected ratios, our observed during this period, 7/12 to 6/13, the observed waiting list mortality, that's the rate of mortality per 100 person years, was 6.9, where our expected was 6.2, not significantly different from ODE. So ODE ratio was not significantly different from 1. What about expected? How is the expected patient and graft survival derived? What is the risk stratification model? And you can divide these risk stratification factors in terms of donor factors, recipient factors, and interactive factors. So if you look at their one-year graft survival risk model to calculate expected graft survival, donor factors include whether the donor was a DCD, how old the donor was, their cause of death, whether it was CVA or traumatic, a donor history of diabetes, hypertension, whether the kidney was pumped, the donor race, donor terminal creatinine, and ECD, yes, no, are the donor factors that are integrated into predicting the expected graft survival. The interactive factors, including how much cold ischemia time we had, the donor-to-recipient weight ratio, HLA mismatches between donor and recipient, and whether that organ came in from an outside recovery DSA, that is, it was an import, was it a local donor. And finally, the recipient factors that are used to calculate what the expected graft survival is, including CPRA. Obviously, the higher the CPRA, the higher the risk of graft loss, whether there was a previous transplant independent of a CPRA, recipient age, recipient BMI, the diagnosis, HCV positive, which negatively affects graft survival, insurance coverage, which is interesting, private versus not, race, gender, and time on renal replacement, which we all know that affects kidney transplant survival as well. So how did we do these last two periods? 94% was observed during the graft survival period, 95% was our predicted, and 97%, these are one-year adult graft and patient survival, so the patient survival is on the right there, 97.56 when the predicted was 97.25, numerically different but not statistically significantly different from what is expected given our degree of illness of our patients and the degree of quality of the donors that we've selected. The O to E ratio with a 95% confidence interval is another way to express this. And if you look at it, the previous slide only included one-year patient and graft survival. If you look at our one-month, one-year, and three-year graft failures, it turns out that we actually have better than expected three-year graft survival. You can see that the O to E ratio is 0.73. The number of graft failures is 73% of what one would expect, and that 95% confidence interval does not span one. So actually, we are statistically better than expected in terms of three-year graft survival. We're at expected in terms of one-month and one-year survival. These are different cohorts of patients that are followed out different numbers of years. Now, here's a program. I'm not going to mention which program it is. It's actually a decently big one in the Midwest. That I looked at their statistics that just came out, and if you look at their one-year deaths, they were expected to have, during that period, 12 deaths. They had 20, so 8 more than expected. The problem is that if you look at their one-year observed to expected deaths, they're 1.66. Remember, the magic number for CMS is 1.5. And are they different in terms of a p-value of less than 0.5? Actually, they are. They're statistically higher rates of death at 1 year at 0.044. So their 95% confidence interval does not span one. So this is a center that may actually come up for flagging, especially if for two periods in a row this occurs. This is a center that really should look at why their patient deaths are higher than expected. Now, it could be that they're just not properly coding things or entering things for UNOS, that they're not capturing the comorbidities accurately. But whatever the source is, whether they're really selecting patients poorly, selecting donors poorly, or just not coding well or submitting their data well, this is a center that must examine their QI processes. Now, what about this business about risk stratification? This center said, well, your model doesn't risk stratify enough. It doesn't take into account coronary artery disease, which it doesn't. The SRTR doesn't risk stratify for coronary disease. But the question is whether adding the coronary disease actually adds a lot to the model beyond just diabetes, hypertension, other things. Now, what happens if you don't do risk stratification enough? Well, if you have your expected rates to be higher than what they should be, and if you do too little risk stratification, then what you promote from the transplant center is risk-averse behavior. And the argument is that when you have risk-averse behavior, you won't tackle those sick patients that might be at higher risk, and it may inhibit innovation. Those are the arguments for centers that want more and more risk stratification. Now, is there such a thing as too much risk stratification? And I would argue there is. The ridiculous example is that if you only transplant dead people, your expected survival is zero. And so, you know, you're going to meet that bar pretty easily, 0% survival. But if you risk stratify for every single thing we do in terms of how bad a donor we accept and how bad a recipient that we take in, and you have an expected survival, let's say, of 75%, no center in the country has 75% one-year patient survival. Let's say your expected was that, and you achieved 80% survival. Well, you're better than expected because your risk stratification took into the fact that you're transplanting, you know, 90-year-old people with no legs and end-stage coronary disease, and you're to say that you've reached that target actually would promote more, potentially more risky behavior and futile transplant. And certainly in our field where we have such a limited source, it may not result in the best use of organs. So I would argue we should look at both risk stratified data and completely non-risk stratified results and have a floor beyond which you shouldn't go down. Otherwise, you're really not being good stewards of organs. So I would say to measure transplant center performance and quality, you should really look at both. Again, should there be an absolute non-risk stratified standard? I would say yes. And I would say we should have a lower, an absolute rate of success that you shouldn't go lower beyond. Now, what about other quality control techniques in other industries? There's many ways to do statistical processing control, and one of those processes is called the Q-sum technique. And these are Q-sum statistical control charts, which were developed to study industrial processes. And they're designed to signal if there's a deviation from accepted production standards, you know, one error in a million of a widget or a Toyota Prius or whatever. And these cumulative sums of events are used in quality control to really look at and trend events over real time. So you must have real time going data going in to have these Q-sum charts make any sense. And now these Q-sum techniques are now recently been used in medicine to track surgical outcomes. I'm going to skip this slide. They do have a nice graphical representation of outcomes or bad events over time, and they are risk-adjusted depending on what you think the event rate should be based on how sick your patients are, et cetera. And they plot outcomes over time, and there are two types of charts. One's called an O minus E chart, or a two-sided Q-sum, and one's a one-sided chart. And trends in that plot line suggest that you're either getting better or you're getting worse. And once the trend line reaches a certain predefined level, it sort of signals, the Q-sum signals, and say, maybe you should pay attention to what's going on at your center. And again, so this is a graphical representation of observed versus expected over time. And I'll show you a couple examples of this. So this is our kidney program and our most recent Q-sum, or one of the recent Q-sum charts. This is called the two-sided, or the observed minus expected, where zero, if the line is at zero, you have the exact same number of observed events, such as patient death, as you expect. So anything above zero is not good. Anything below zero is good. You can see the slope of the line over time depends on how many transplants you do and how sick they are. And every spike up is actually an event meaning patient death within 1 year. So you can see that over time, there was a little bit of an error between 7 of 2011 and 1 of 2012 where the line was starting to creep up. But at no point did our observed minus expected line go above zero for a significant portion of time. And actually, in the most recent era, the numbers of deaths that we're seeing is not actually up to the point where it would even meet the expected number of patient deaths within the first year. Now, this is a one-sided Q-sum, which is a little bit different in that there's a 5% threshold that's pre-designated as a signaling criteria. Now, that's not 5% deaths, but the 5% threshold is to mark where the events happening over time would be more than the percentage is likely more than 5% that it's not just out of chance. So in other words, it's the threshold where p-value would be less than 0.05 if it crossed that threshold, and every spike up, you never actually go below zero because, you know, it's a one-sided Q-sum. Only events go up, and then it goes back down to zero. But if more events accumulate over a period of time to reach the 5% threshold, it means you have a statistically larger number of events, that is patient deaths here, than you would expect over that unit of time. This is the one-year graft survival ODE. The last one was last two charts was patient deaths. Now here you can see at some points we were having fewer numbers of graft losses over time, but as of early 2013, there was a trend that we were above this line of zero, that is the observed minus expected numbers of graft failures was actually higher than zero. Fortunately, it actually came back down as we didn't have any graft losses between the latter periods over here, and that the line came down below zero. Again, this period of time was a period of time where we had a number of graft losses in a row, but actually you can see that we were well below the 5% threshold, that these are still within the realm of occurring by chance. If this line kept on going up like this and we had more numbers of graft losses that crossed here, that would certainly be more an area of concern for us at UCSF. So in terms of QSOM charting, it's actually provides a pretty reliable risk-adjusted method of tracking outcomes of a clinical process over time and can be tuned to balance the sensitivity, need for sensitivity, as well as clinical failures, and reduces the number of false positive signals, and also may alert the center for earlier detection of adverse outcomes before you get to the PSR values, which are 1 or 3 year graft survival numbers that are lumped together. Now, the other part of having a decent national transplant QI program has to do with more granular data. And why do we need that? Well, like I mentioned, we have 1 year in patient graft survival, and these are very gross measures. These are 30,000-foot measures of the quality of a transplant program. They certainly can't be used in any provider-specific fashion, and we need benchmarks for provider-specific occurrence as well. We need to be able to identify outliers and really identify the areas for performance improvement, because a great majority of centers actually fit into exactly where you expect it to be. So that doesn't help you decide where you should be concentrating on to improve performance. And then finally, when you have a range of things that are occurring across the country, you can identify best practices, disseminate them, and people have shown that these sort of practices and collaboratives actually do help in terms of bringing the whole system up in terms of improvement. So what about surgical complications? Well, the identification of surgical complications is actually quite poor. In most cases, they're done retrospectively, or in our case, well, we often rely on an M&M conference, the sensitivity of which happens to be not the best, especially compared to very strict things like NISQIP, which is an American College of Surgeons quality improvement program. There's very poor risk adjustment for surgical complications, and again, we have lack of relevant benchmarks. In the transplant patient population, we don't even know what an expected rate of SSI should be, or the expected rate of ureteral complications or readmissions, et cetera. I think we should look at different endpoints, some of which will be team metrics still, and some of which may be surgeon or provider specific. For example, we talk about really looking at readmissions, which I think is important, probably an important quality measure, but I think maybe even more than the number of readmissions is perhaps the total number of inpatient days that a patient spends in the first year post-transplant. Similarly, we talk about patient loss and graft loss, and Flavio's pointed out to me in some clinical studies you have a composite endpoint of patient loss, graft loss, and EGFR less than 30, which to me is a much more a robust measure of the quality of the kidney that you're giving to a patient, not just whether the patient is still off dialysis, hanging out there with a creatinine of 3 or 4 in 1 year. So I think that these are things that we have to think about, changing our endpoints to think about measuring quality in a more granular fashion. What are some of the provider-specific results or metrics that I'm proposing for surgeons? Well, maybe blood loss, total blood transfused in the first 72 hours post-op, a total need for reoperation. What's the rate of reoperation for a surgeon? What is the rate of vascular complications, thrombosis? What's the rate of ureteral complications? Those are the things that I think are reasonable to think about in terms of provider-specific results for a surgeon. So one of my hats is interacting with the American College of Surgeons to create a new transplant QI program for the country that will have accurate prospective data collection on surgical complications, that we will have to develop robust risk adjustment models, and that the American College of Surgeons actually has a program called NISQIP that tests interrelated reliability and accuracy in terms of charting and chart abstraction, and then that would provide us national benchmarks and comparison across centers and providers and identification of best practices. So what is the future of quality and reimbursement? Well, these terms are with us to stay. They're not going away. Value-based purchasing will become more and more important. The PQRS program, which is a physician quality reporting system, right now a lot of us didn't participate because it was a 0.5% incentive of charges, and that was a piddly amount. But now it's going to go to 2% penalty, and actually they're predicting that we're going to go to up to either 8 to 10% penalty for not reporting in the PQRS system. So this is not a small chunk of change. In addition, maintenance of competency will, in fact, be mandated for all of us, and they will undoubtedly involve quality assurance activities that not only drill down in terms of the overall hospital dialysis center results, but individual metrics. So we're going to have to really look at our individual performance in some way. So in summary, the environment is continuing to change. The quality will clearly take center stage from both legislative, regulatory environment, as well as financial reimbursement. And other metrics that we have to come up with is really a metric of appropriate care. How do we figure out whether someone's getting appropriate care? And then there's, of course, the value formula. So in terms of projects that I'm personally involved in terms of patient safety, we want to try to make sure that everything gets done in the operating room that we want it to, that operative debriefings is something we want to invoke at UCSF, that we're involved in creating this national TransQIP program, Transplant Quality Improvement Program, which is a collaboration between the ASTS and the ACS. I think we can always try to do better, refine our processes, increase patient safety, and, of course, enhance patient experience. We have to have good metrics developed by smart people to look at access, appropriateness of care, and, of course, maintain our accountability for individual providers and not just say that everything's just a systems issue. And more patient satisfaction surveys will become more important. And, again, if we can eliminate disparities, improve access, and improve care, I think these are the areas of focus for quality, and better to come from us than from some regulator or some government agency, because I think we are the ones that we should be telling them what the metrics should be, not the other way around. Okay. Thanks.
Do you have to report patients that you evaluate that don't list?
You know, that's a very good question. We only report how many patients we list. I think it would be a good study in terms of, quote-unquote, an intent-to-treat analysis of what actually happens to patients that get referred and what are their eventual outcomes. How many get turned down? How many get accepted? And once they get accepted, do they actually reach the end point of transplant? Do they get taken off? Those sort of things. Those are metrics that are sort of hard to figure out because, obviously, the denominator depends on who you get referred. So if you get referred a huge number of inappropriate candidates, you may be turning down a fair number. Now, I saw one statistic that said, I believe, about of all the patients on dialysis, I think about 25% are waitlisted for a transplant. So that means about 75% are not on any transplant list. Now, that may be that the entire population of dialysis patients are such bad candidates, but it may be reflective of other things such as access or behavior at a transplant center. Now, the problem is that we are incentivized in many ways to turn down our high-risk patients because we're held to certain standards. We want to get good outcomes. We don't want huge waitlist mortality, and we don't want post-transplant deaths or complications. So we're in a way incentivized in a lot of ways to not accept those high-risk patients. And that may be appropriate given the shortage of the organs. And the other thing I wanted to mention is as our patient population gets older, even those patients, you may not be adding any years of life, but even from the quality of life standpoint, when you do a big operation on a frail person that's older, it's quite clear, the literature is becoming quite clear that you don't actually help their quality of life. In other words, they do not return to a level of function that they even had pre-op. So I think all these data are necessary to really inform the transplant center who they should be turning down, who they should be accepting, and really giving a realistic view of what the landscape is, and including the notion that if you're diabetic and you're old, you have such a teeny chance of making it to the end of our transplant waiting list, and that, you know, living donor is really the only way to go. So I think these are messages that we need to get across. Agreed. I think that assessment is actually not in the risk stratification except for private insurance. There actually, UNOS does collect the level of education that a patient has. And the level of social support and level of education does have something to do with outcomes. It's not as big as some of the other things that predict for outcomes. But I think an assessment of understanding and really whether a patient is even informed to the level they can actually consent to these things is an important addition that we have to really try to assess. Some folks are getting around it through electronic means to try to figure out whether a patient actually understands what they're getting into. But I agree with you wholeheartedly. It's a waste of time and a waste of resources to put a kidney into a patient that really can't take care of those things. Now, we need better assessment tools to figure that out. Thanks, Florian.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.